smart. Good evening, I'm Chris, an alcoholic. And as it was mentioned, this is my third and final week. So I'll try not to set the bar very low on my way out the door, I guess. I was sitting up here and I was thinking about, my perception at least is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk a lot about change, right? How we have to change, how we must change, necessary change. We talk a lot about change and, you hear things like change or die and things like that. And as I'm sitting up here, I'm thinking about just the change that's happened for me in the last 3 weeks since I've been coming here. You know, I was nervous and intimidated and scared and all those things that we don't like to admit, right, about our insecurities when I was coming here for the first week. And, you know, felt a little bit better the next week. And then I walk in the room tonight and I see a bunch of faces that, you know, are more familiar to me than they probably should be for somebody you've only seen 3 times. You know, and that change that's taken place over that time, because we've all shared some stuff, right? We've all talked a lot about, you know, how we feel and things that have happened to us. And, you know, I think more so in Alcoholics Anonymous than anywhere else, we can be very, very candid about how we feel. And you get a lot of nodding heads. Like, I feel like a lot of times the crazier thing you say, the more the heads nod, you know? And that's something that made me very comfortable. And so, you know, I should be thanking you guys for having me here, because it's been an incredible experience. And, tonight we're going to talk a little bit about 10, 11, and 12. In the first 2 weeks we talked about, you know, the theme that that I was thinking about when I started here a couple weeks ago was, you know, the idea of desperation, inspiration, and perpetuation, right? And so there was that level of desperation that I came in with that helped me in the, you know, steps 1, 2, and 3, the desperation that I had and how terribly beat up and sick I was and when I came here on July 7th of 2015. And, you know, I rode that desperation, but I was, you know, I was told I had to find some inspiration along the way, right, that was going to inspire me for Alcoholics Anonymous. And not only that, but also the life that would be, that has been given to me as a result of that. And I have to tell you, something that's really inspiring is to be in a big book workshop with so many people counting days. You know, because I don't see that a lot. I didn't do that a lot in the beginning. And it's inspiring to see people who are coming in and counting days. I mean, talk about putting the odds in your favor, right? Coming to things like big book workshops when you're counting days early on. I feel like that's just something that's going to be tremendously helpful, in my own opinion. And then we'll talk a little bit about the perpetuation, right, in 10, 11, and 12 tonight. And I shared a little bit of my experience. You know, I had some exposure to the big book, right? People put it in front of me. People begged me to read it. People begged me to go to AA, but I didn't have an experience with it until I sat down with a sponsor and other men in Alcoholics Anonymous and spent time going through it. But, you know, the perpetuation, the ongoing continuation, I don't like to call it the maintenance, the maintenance steps or anything like that, only because it feels like I'm not growing if I'm just maintaining. So when I use the perpetuation word, which I say a lot, but it's because I looked it up and I feel smart saying it. It's not something I came up with on my own. But you know, these three things were told to me were going to be of incredible importance from the moment I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I came to AA in 2015, I was very sick. I was shaking. I was yellow. And I was desperate. And, you know, that's just how I was when I came in. And a lot of people come in physically that way, and some people don't. And that doesn't really matter to me how they look physically on the outside, whether they're hurting a lot or not, because I feel that anybody who's come to Alcoholics Anonymous and has stuck around, we've all felt the same level of hopelessness inside. And that's one thing that we all have in common. And so, you know, I was feeling that hopelessness and that desperation, and I asked the gentleman to be my sponsor when I was, a couple days sober, and he said to me, "Are you willing to go to any lengths like your life depends on it?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, I'll be your sponsor." And I turned to walk away. And he said, "Hold on, don't go anywhere." And I was like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "I went to a meeting, I got a sponsor, this is a really good day in AA, I'm all set, you know, like, I'll see you tomorrow. Like, let's not do too much work, you know?" And he said, he pointed out this book, which is the same book he gave me at that very first meeting I was at. And he said, "I want you to start reading page 86 every single day. I want you to pray. I don't care if you don't know how to pray. I just want you to pray. Start saying some prayers. And he goes, and I want you to start helping other alcoholics immediately, because in this program we live in 10, 11, and 12. And this guy wasn't yelling at me. He was inspiring me. You know, he's a basketball coach. And for me, it was kind of like one of those movie halftime speeches, the way he said it. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm going to do it. And I said, I don't know how I'm going to. Said, I'm going to be able to read page 86, you know, and we're going to get into some of that stuff in a second here. And I said, and I'll start praying. I'll start saying something. I'll start repeating some prayers, whatever I need to do. And I said, but I don't know how I'm going to help anybody. I said, look at me. You know, I'm shaking and I'm yellow. And he said, you got a car outside. I don't know how you never got a DUI in that. You know, why don't you just go outside and offer some people a ride home? And there I was with 5 days sober outside smoking a cigarette, shaking profusely like, does anybody want a ride home? You know? And people got in my car, you know, and God bless them. And there's always somebody to help in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to. And that's what I learned from that. And what I also learned is that a few weeks later, when physically I started to feel a little bit better and I had a couple meetings under my belt, and I, you know, the thought creeps in my head that, you know, I got this, right? That kind of thing. And all of a sudden, I've been going to meetings every single day for 25, 30 days. And I say to myself, well, I don't need to go to one today. I've gone to 30 straight. Why do I need to go to another one? And then all of a sudden, I realize there's somebody that I agreed to pick up, right? Or there's somebody who's calling me because I've gotten to know them, just like we've gotten to all know each other. And all of a sudden, I'm accountable to somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And even when I don't want to go to a meeting, I don't want to mess them up. I want to at least help them get to their meeting. And, you know, and that was the first experience that I had with the, you know, perpetuation in 10, 11, and 12. So I'm going to start that here and talk a little bit about step 10 on page 84. And I'm just going to start with that first paragraph. So we ended right on 84 at the end of 9 when we went through the 9-step promises last week. And now that first paragraph starts, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along the way. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God to at once remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So one of the things that I was taught in reading this paragraph is that you actually find all of the steps right here in this paragraph, right? And the other thing in here is that it says our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. It doesn't mean that once you finish 9 that you've now become a great guy, right? Or a great girl or a great person, and that you're now, you know, clean as the driven snow, and that everyone's going to think you're wonderful and that you're done, right? It means that there's still work to do. It's an everyday growing and understanding that you need to maintain. And I like how it says, you know, we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, right? Right there, steps 4, getting into 5. When these crop up, right, in our character defects, 6 and 7, we ask God to over months remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends if we've harmed anyone, right? Those are the things that we did in 8 and 9. So we're just, you know, taking what we've learned in those and we're applying them here in step 10. And then came the, you know, I always say it as like, and then the bill arrived, right? We resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. I was scared to help people. I was okay driving people around, but I was scared of the idea of actually trying to help anyone any other way. And I learned a lot about that in working through 10 and 11 with a sponsor. Because the next piece here on 85, it says, we will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. So that I feel like is the most extravagant promise of all that I definitely was certain was never going to happen for me when I read it. The idea that I guess the words, the position of neutrality, the idea of being in a position of neutrality with alcohol, really was one that I was like, maybe for you, but not for me, you know? I don't know if you guys have this, but every once in a while I have those moments where people will say, you know, it says it in the big book, do this, this will happen. If we continue to this, this will happen. And I'm like, I don't know about you guys, like, I'm actually sick, you know? Like, this isn't going to work for me, maybe for you. And this was one of those paragraphs where I read it and I thought, I can't imagine a place where I'm not swearing it off and I'm not really talking about it. It's just not a part of my life. It's very hard to describe. And I think it's probably why they say in here that it'll be given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. You know, like one day I'm driving in my car and I just realized it was 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. I don't know. It was dark out. And I said, oh, wow, I haven't thought about drinking today, you know? And then I was like, and I think I might not have thought about it yesterday either. And I was floored, you know? And then I was like all nervous because I was like, well, now I've thought of it. Does this mean I'm thinking about drinking? Like total alcoholic, like over analysis, you know? I was like, now I'm going to be stuck in this cycle of like, is this really thinking about drinking or am I just thinking about how I'm not thinking about drinking? And so, you know, I went through that whole cycle, but, you know, I remember where I was when that happened, and I remember crying my eyes out because I thought, I read this somewhere in the big book, and at the time I didn't know where it was. And I mean, you guys see I have little notes and posts and stuff because I'm not somebody who's going to tell you exactly where everything is on every page in the big book. But I will tell you this. I remember saying, I read that in that book. They told me that would happen, you know, and I didn't believe it. But, you know, it started to happen to me. And then that very next paragraph is just a little bit of a reminder, right? Like, I'm in this position of neutrality. I'm in this position where I find myself going certain places and being around certain things and not even realizing that alcohol is present. I'm aware that like I need to keep a conscious eye on what I'm drinking, right? And things like that. But I'm not really obsessed with how many drinks someone else is having, how many times they open up another bottle of wine. I just all of a sudden wasn't really concerning myself with that. And that, again, can be the subtle foe where I start to think, well, maybe I don't have an alcohol problem if I'm not thinking about it, you know? Or maybe I could think, I've got this, right? I don't have any other issues. You know, and this book was written by two pretty smart folks, right? With the help of some other really smart folks. And then they nail you in the next paragraph, right? It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, right? So there's these points, at least in my experience, interpretation, whatever you want to call it, when we read this book, where there are certain things where there are miracles that are happening, right? I'm in a position of neutrality with alcohol. I'm not thinking about it. But then everybody who wrote it, it's written by, you know, a bunch of other drunks like me. So they also know what I'm going to do next. So they catch me and they stop me short of that by saying, well, hold on, you can't rest on your laurels. Like, don't start thinking that. Like, there's still work to be done. And then the last part on this page I'll read is middle of the paragraph. In the last paragraph there, it says, if we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of his spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Okay, so on the next page, we're going to read something in step 11 about what happens in the morning and at night. And something that somebody pointed out to me was that, you know, I'm not working step 10 when I'm reading those morning and night things, right? Those are things that help me in step 11. Step 10 is actually what I'm doing on a continuous basis throughout the day to take stock of what I'm doing, right? I heard somebody once say, you know, I don't only do my step 10 when I get in bed at night because I don't get in trouble in bed at night anymore. You know, he's like, I get in trouble during the day. You know, that's when I need to be taking stock of it and catching those things. So I need to be checking myself. I've heard people who have said that they set alarms during the day, self-checking, you know, 11:15 every day. Like, how am I doing? How big of a hole have I dug myself? You know, that kind of thing. And those are the types of things that I learned in step 10. Now it gets into step 11 and it talks about step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. I'm only reading that line because I love the idea when they say step 11 suggests prayer and meditation, right? It's just a reminder that like no one's required to do any of these things, right? You're not required, you know, we don't pull your AA card, you know, we don't burn it, you know, if you're not doing it. You know, nobody, I drove up here with a friend tonight. He didn't ask me how many times I prayed today. You know, he didn't ask me which step I was working. When I'm off kilter, they'll say, how's your spiritual condition, for sure. But, you know, we don't force anybody to do it. And sometimes I think that's the part that creates the attraction in AA instead of the promotion. Now, I am going to read on page 86 those two paragraphs. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and require what corrective measures should be taken. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So, you know, there's something that happened to me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous is that I learned about this idea of, quote-unquote, getting ready for bed. Like, I don't know if anyone else experienced this, but, you know, normal people, like, at night when it's time to go to sleep, they do something called getting ready for bed, which means that maybe they lay out the clothes they're going to wear the next day, you know, they put some of the dishes away, they brush their teeth, you know, they clean up a little bit. I never really knew that concept, right? I mostly just passed out, right? So there's this whole idea of, like, getting ready for bed. And I was like, I don't even know what that means, you know? I'm like, what do you guys do, you know? Like, and I, you know, I had to be shown that there. And people would tell me that. They're like, brush your teeth, put your clothes out, you know? Like, and then I was reminded, like, you know, we do those things, right, to take care of ourselves. You know, some people, whatever they need to do, right? They do their whole ritual before they go to bed. And then it was like, so when you get in bed, what are you doing to take care of your mind? Right? Are you going to go through this and spend a little bit of time? And, you know, it can, for me, it can be as simple as, like, how do I feel about how I did today? You know, how do I feel about my effort today? You know, I worked for somebody years ago who would always say, you know, at the end of the day, do you feel like you put your best effort in? And I hated that guy because I was drinking then and I never put my best effort in, right? But there was people who would get up and be like, I'm satisfied. They're like, I worked my butt off today, you know? And that's how it is. When I get in bed at the end of the day, like, did I do my best today? Do I need to take care or fix something now? You know, like, maybe I wasn't nice to my wife. Maybe I need to, you know, I need to roll over and make an amends right away. Right? Or there are times where I will send emails to myself. There's a reminder, when you get up tomorrow, take care of this. You don't need to call your mom at midnight and tell her you're sorry for something you said offhand. But, you know, my mother's got enough midnight phone calls. She doesn't need any more from me, right? But I do need to remember that when I wake up tomorrow, I need to do that. And the same thing upon awakening, right? So when you get up in the morning, I've also heard it described like this. When people get up in the morning, they do a lot of different things, right? They shower, brush their teeth. Some people go work out. Some people walk the dog, right? Use the bathroom. You do everything you need to do in terms of your morning ritual. Like, all those things you easily find time for, because they're important to you, right? I want to feel good. I want to look good. I want to have a good meal today, so I'm going to make my breakfast. All these things that you easily make time for without even thinking about it. So am I willing to make, I don't know, a minute, 2 minutes, longer, shorter, whatever you want, but am I at least willing to make some sort of time in that morning to at least say, like, and I'll be very honest, there are some days where I'm like, I wake up and I am not in a good mood, and I'm like, hey, man, and I say, that's how I talk to God sometimes. I'm like, hey, man, can you just keep the jerk away until like 4 p.m.? Because I've got a lot of stuff I've got to do today, and I really don't want to have to make amends to all these people I'm about to interact with. But, you know, sometimes it's as simple as that, and sometimes it's much more than that. And one of the things that helped me with that was consistently speaking with a sponsor and other members of Alcoholics Anonymous for me in the morning. You know, I call my sponsor every day around 7 a.m. or so. And that keeps us accountable. You know, that that allows us to understand when the other person isn't necessarily sounding like themselves, because we've been around each other so much and we've talked so much that we can tell when the other person's a little bit off. And we'll say, hey man, did you pray today? You know, imagine that. Like when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not expect that I was going to call another man at 7:10 in the morning and start the conversation with like, how are you? Not like, let's just lay into how I am and who I'm angry at today, but let's start with how are you, right? And actually listen, not just wait to speak, but actually listen. Did you pray today, right? How's the prayer thing going? And when we hang up, say, I love you, you know? I'm like, these are three things that I did not expect I was ever going to be comfortable doing, but it takes repetition. And that's where I had to really get into the repetition of praying and meditating and developing a conscious contact with a higher power. And that's one of the things on page 87 that that they talk about. It says we sometimes, it's kind of nestled in the second to last paragraph, or the last paragraph, it says we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. They also say there are many helpful books also. So for me, I didn't know how to pray. You know, my relationship with a higher power consisted of, I grew up going to a Catholic grade school. I was fortunate that I had a very standard Catholic grade school experience. I did not suffer some of the harms or atrocities that you've heard some others have suffered. For me, it was just run of the mill, you know. But I did not have a spirituality or any type of relationship with a God of my understanding when I was younger, right? And I think I shared this, like, you know, my experience with the church was, I told the priest a couple things, like I said a few curse words, right, when I went to confession, and then, you know, got sentenced to a couple Hail Marys and said, all right, done with that sacrament, on to the next. I participated as an altar boy because it made Mass go faster when I was moving around, right? And you had a chance to, you know, take a sip of the wine here and there, and, you know, things like that. I got to learn how to use matches and, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, and the, you know, during school, if you were an altar boy for funerals, they would let you out to at his class to go serve at the funeral, right? Those are the things that I knew about, you know, religion and church and all that kind of stuff. Joined a youth group in high school because that was a good place to talk to girls on a Sunday night. And that was the extent of it, you know. And so I had to work at building a relationship with a higher power because, you know, my father passed away fairly suddenly when I was about 22 years old. And I had said a prayer to God asking for my father to be at my college graduation because he had gotten a little sick. And at the time, it was a little bit of, I felt like an elaborate, or I felt like I was just being a little bit, I don't know, arrogant or something like that. But he wasn't that sick, is what I'm saying. And sure enough, he was at my college graduation, and a day later, he went into the hospital, and 3 weeks later, he passed away. And at that point, I swore off God. And I said, I'm never going to talk to that guy again, you know, because he screwed me. That was my thought, right? And fast forward almost 8-10 years, right? I'm in the throes of my alcoholism. I just want things to get better. And I say a prayer to God. And my prayer to God goes somewhat like, hey, God, we haven't talked in a while, but I figured out how you can make things up to me. And I said, you know, you can just, you know, and, you know, I didn't want to waste his time. So I came with my list of demands readily prepared. And I said, you know, you can get me a better job, my own place to live. You know, I'll kick this alcohol thing. And that actually happened pretty quickly. And, you know, I shared that a couple weeks ago, that actually spiraled me into, you know, a very, very isolated, painful and terrifying place for the last 4 years of my drinking. And it was exactly where God needed me to be, right? It was exactly what I had to go through. It was exactly part of the plan. But when I came in here, I didn't really know how I was going to develop this relationship with a higher power. So I had two things. One, not to go backwards, but on one, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, those things that we just read on 86 and 87, when I came in, my sponsor handed me a little wallet-sized blue card that was laminated. And on the first side, it was the first paragraph. And on the next side, it was the other paragraph. And he said, and if you don't know how to pray, just read these things every morning. And I said, okay. And so I took those out and I read those every morning. And then, as I just read on 87, that paragraph where we sometimes select a few prayers. So, you know, I dug back into that Catholic school past in grade school, and I found two prayers I could remember, the Our Father and the Hail Mary, and every morning I'd get up and I'd say those two prayers and I'd read this blue card. And that was it. And I was about 70 or 80 days sober, and I went to a convention with my sponsor, and we're all sitting around these round tables like you guys are sitting at. It's one of those where everyone's together for the whole day. In and out, speakers, way too much coffee, candy bars on every table, just one of those things that now, being an AA, I actually love, right? And there was a guy sitting next to me, and my sponsor says, show that guy your blue card. And this guy said, oh, look at this. He's like, you know, I really could use something like this. And my sponsor said, give that guy your blue card. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm like, this is mine, you know? I'm like, you gave this to me, you know? And he says, no, man. He goes, you got to pass it on. He goes, you memorize those things, right? And I said, yeah, you know, for the most part, you know. And he's like, well, you know where to find them, so give the guy your card. And that's what he said. And, you know, and that was one of the first experiences I had with just being of service to somebody else in any way I could. So I've got these, you know, I've got these set of prayers, right? And then all of a sudden I'm going to a bunch of meetings. I'm going to a big book meeting. And in this big book meeting, they open up every meeting. Or excuse me, they close every meeting with the third step prayer, right? So at first, when I'm coming around to AA, they're saying this prayer, and I don't know up from down, so I'm like, whatever, they're saying a prayer, the meeting's going to be over soon, that's fine. And then over time, all of a sudden, I started to feel a little left out that I didn't have that prayer memorized like they did. And my sponsor at the same time was telling me to memorize that prayer, right? So I learned to memorize the third set prayer going to a Tuesday night big book study, because I wanted to be part of the crowd, if we're being very honest. I wanted to know the prayer you guys all knew. And now all of a sudden, I'm getting up in the morning and I'm saying my prayers. And now I've got three, right? Now I've got three prayers I can say, right? And then we get into the seventh step. And all of a sudden, I'm at meetings where people say the seventh step prayer. And I'm like, well, here's another one, right? And now I got four prayers, right? Throw a serenity prayer in there. I got a good mix of five. Five's my lucky number. I say the five same prayers every morning. And that's what I start doing. Right, and then somebody tells me they wake up every day and they say, thank you, God, for keeping me sober. Please keep me sober today. And so that's how I start. Right, and so that's what I started doing to get into the habit of saying those prayers. And there's a sentence here right at the bottom of that page 87 that says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful to act for the right thought or action. Those prayers helped me with this pause thing. Right, because when I was agitated, which was quite often early on in sobriety, I'd get agitated, I'd get upset, and I'd be like, I'm supposed to pause, I'm supposed to pause, I'm supposed to pause. And I'd say that like 10 times, and I'm like, have I paused long enough? Can I freak out now? You know? And obviously, I wasn't pausing long enough. So I started to say those prayers. Right? I started to say those five prayers in my head. And that's how I got myself into a place where I could try and pause when I was agitated and just help myself get through that moment, mm-hmm. You know? And the biggest thing I learned in some of those moments is that I guess I was under the impression that if I pause long enough that I'm actually going to get the rock solid, this is the way to go answer if I pause long enough. The truth is, at least for me, I'm just pausing long enough so that I don't act on my initial reaction. Because that's almost always wrong, at least for me. And so that's what I would do, and I would pause that. I remember being on Route 287, and I was driving somewhere, and there was a ton of traffic, and I was turned around, and I was a little lost, and I was angry, and I had to make a phone call, and I just knew that if somebody said the wrong thing to me on this phone call, I was going to freak out. And I paused, and I said those prayers, and I called the person. And we had a normal conversation, like normal adult human beings, and we both went about our days. And it wasn't even anything crazy we were talking about, but I just knew that I was in a bad mood and I was looking for a fight. And I hung up the phone and I thought, this thing works. This pause thing works. There's really something to it. So a couple things on step 11 at the end here. One of the things that I struggle a lot with in prayer and meditation is how to trust God when bad things happen. You know, there are things that have happened to me and things that have happened to my friends and family and people that I know and I love and I care about. And sometimes all I want to do is tell God, like, you dropped the ball on this one. You know, you got it wrong. And so I just try and pray more. You know, I just say, hey, I don't know why you have it going like this. I don't really like how it's going, but I know that you have a plan, and I know that it's going to all make sense in the long run, and I know that whoever's hurting, you're going to take care of them. And a lot of times what I was taught is to say, you know, you can take a day off from looking out for me today. Just please put all your effort into helping my friend. And that was a big thing that I had to learn, because I really struggled with coping with when bad things happen. And it's, you know, a lot of it's because I'm selfish, right? Because there are bad things happening in the world all the time. But when they happen to somebody that, like, that happened to me or somebody that I know or love, all of a sudden I'm like shaking my fist in the air like, God, you got it all wrong, you know? Like, but there are things like this happening every day. But that was something that really I had to work at and build a relationship with God to help get over. And that's one of the biggest things that I think about in this is, you know, the relationship that I have, right, with a God of my understanding. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I mean, look, everybody in this room has at least one relationship in their life, right? Friend, significant other, pet, whatever it is. There's some relationship, a sponsor, any relationship that you have. It takes work, right? The relationship I have with my sponsor now was not the relationship we had when I was counting days, because we didn't know each other as well. We put work into it. It's the same for the relationship with my wife. Same for the relationship with my family or friends or other people. Like, you have to put the effort in, you know? And I had to put the effort in. And I had to, you know, I looked at it at first like I had to put the effort in before God was going to put the effort in. Like, I said, well, I got to put the effort in to pray and trust God and develop this relationship, and then God is going to show himself or herself to me, and it's all going to be done that way. You know, but what I found out in a little bit more of time building that relationship is that, you know, God's always been looking out for me, right? God was never lost. You know, I was the one who was lost, and I was the one who had to find God, you know? When I came in here, God was like, all right, well, at least I could take a little bit of a break. Like, I'm, you know, wasting all my time trying to keep you alive, pal. Like, and now here I am, and I'm able to build a relationship with him. And so that's, you know, I want to make sure we get into step 12 here, but that's a lot of how I pray today. One of the things that I found to be most helpful for me in step 11 is that, again, I think about how things were in the beginning when I'd say those five prayers over and over, and how it is today, because now my relationship with the higher power is far different than was, right, because of that time that we've spent together. I find myself talking conversationally with God, you know, in like almost the same tone that I would talk to a friend, like kind of sarcastic sometimes. You know, sometimes things happen and I just look up and I'm like, I think you're making it unnecessarily hard on us, but I'm going to trust you, you know, or, hey, I know that you have a plan. I trust you. Or, you know, sometimes it's just a quick sentence or a quick word, you know, and I'll say, I don't know what it is, but I'm on board with you. Now, all that said, right, we've talked a lot about steps 1 through 11. And I was told by many people, you know, especially men in my home group who I follow around, they told me the first, you know, without the 12 steps, all you have is a self-help program that'll get you drunk, right? Steps 1 through 11 are just a self-help program that's going to get you drunk if you don't help somebody else. And that scared me because I didn't think I was capable of helping anybody else. Right? And I was super worried that I was going to mess somebody else up. You know? There was a point in time when I was talking about step 11 with my sponsor, and he said, look, you have had an experience with these things, and pretty soon you're going to be sponsoring people, and you're going to have the opportunity to watch them go through that experience. And I was like, can we rewind real quick to the part where you said I want to be sponsoring people pretty soon? Because I was freaked out. You know? I was really, really worried about the idea of sponsoring somebody else, because I just felt like I wasn't going to be any good at it. I was insecure. I was worried. And, you know, and I was reminded, like, I was reminded they already have a fatal illness. You know, there's no wrong way to try and do the right thing. So just try and be helpful to that person. The other thing I was reminded before we get into talking about the 12 step is that there's a gentleman I sat across from who I have a lot of respect for, has been sober a really long time. And I have a tendency to hang on his every word. I'm a little bit of an AA groupie sometimes like that with him. And so it's probably not a healthy relationship, but it is what it is. And he sat across from me one day and he said, you know, you don't need to sponsor somebody to help them. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, everyone needs a sponsor. You know, he said, but it doesn't mean that you have to be everyone's sponsor. You know, you just have to be willing to help them in any way that you can. So we'll talk a little bit about that here in the chapter on working with others on page 89. The first sentence, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. Right? What do I do if I'm in fear, if I'm uncomfortable, if I'm in my head, if I'm not having a good day, if I'm obsessed with myself, if I'm obsessed with how God is supposed to be giving me what I want when I want it? What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And the answer is right there. Go help somebody else. Right? If I call my sponsor today and I tell him I'm upset about something, he will ask me two questions. Did you pray on it? Have you tried to help somebody else? And those are the two things. You know? I don't get to call him. I don't get to do the third part and call him until I've done those first two. And every once in a while, there are times where I'll call him and I'll be like, I did the first two and I'm still all messed up. You got to fix this, you know? And he'll say, go do the first two again. You know? And that's the truth. You know, pick up the phone. Call three alcoholics a day. Try to help somebody else. Give them a ride to a meeting even though you're outside and you're shaking like crazy in front of it because you're new. Do whatever you need to do. And then the next piece here is that second paragraph. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. That was another one of those things where I was like, you know, maybe not, maybe for you guys, but I don't think for me, you know. I don't think that I'm going to find happiness in helping other people. But I will tell you this, the happiest moments that I've had in the time that I've been sober have been watching things happen to other people, not watching things that have happened to me. And I've been overblessed in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have had miraculous, wonderful things happen to me. And I am very grateful for those things. But the things that give me chills, like the moments that, you know, give me goosebumps, that bring me to tears, are not when those things have happened to me. It's been when I've watched something happen to somebody else. You know, this is a contact sport. You know, this is the only way you get to see these things is if you're here. You know, and if you're in front of people and if you're attempting to help them and you're attempting to reach out and try and build that relationship with them. The other thing that I was told here is, you know, the bottom of the page says, because your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. Okay? So I was told that there was two goals that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. One is to obtain the 12th step and the other is to maintain the 12th step. Right? And I can only obtain it by going through the first 11 and reaching my hand out, and I can only maintain it by continuing to reach my hand out and try to help other people. And then as it goes through here and working with others, it solves all of the concerns I have about this whole, how am I going to help somebody? How am I not going to break them? You know, how am I not going to ruin everything? You know, I've ruined everything else. How am I going to actually help somebody? It's literally the blueprint for how to help anybody that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many answers in here. It talks here, you know, let me find the page here. It talks through when you meet somebody on the second paragraph, middle way through the, third paragraph, it says, ask him if he wants to quit for good and if he would go to any extreme to do so. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as a part of their own recovery, try to help others. And we'll be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself upon him. Right? We don't chase people in AA, at least I was told. Right? We don't chase them. The harder you chase somebody, the further they're going to go from Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? You have to be the attraction. You have to be here and you have to be willing to listen. And if they don't want help, then that's okay. Right? If they're not willing or they don't want help or they're not in a place where they need help, then it's okay to move on and it's okay to try and help somebody else. On page 92, second to last paragraph, it says, I'm just going to read the one sentence. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Right? So We laugh a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of my most favorite things about this place. Because when I came here, I thought I wasn't allowed to laugh. Right? I was 5 days sober. I went to a meeting on the beach. We live right near the beach on the Jersey Shore. I went to a meeting on the beach. One of the guys right before the meeting told a joke that any five-year-old boy would think is hilarious, and I have that kind of sense of humor, so I thought it was hilarious too, and then I stopped myself because I was like, wait a second, I thought we're not supposed to laugh and smile. You know, I thought I was supposed to be here like I was going to a wake for my alcoholism, and they said, you know, and they saw me do it. They saw me laugh, they saw me stop, they saw me look around to see if anyone saw me laughing, and then he said, you know, it's okay, you're allowed to laugh here. And then that same guy went into a meeting, right, and shared some of the most beautiful, intimate things I've ever heard about spirituality. You know? And that's what they said. They said, it's okay to laugh. It's okay to smile. Right? But also sometimes when we're in the room, we're in the room. Right? We're here because this is a fatal illness. Let's not forget that. You know? And that taught me a lot. When I read about this, they said, continue to speak of it as an illness and a fatal malady. Because I've had a lot of guys who tried to 12-step me who were laughing and smiling. But at some point, they came around and said, like, but you get you're going to die from this, right? You know? And that was one of the things where I've always tried to hold on to that when you're trying to help somebody else. Right? Always talk about it as something that's a fatal malady. Right? Because a lot of the time, it is also, to me, again, this is only my experience or whatever, my opinion, is, you know, there's a lot of, you can come to AA if you want, if you think you're an alcoholic, you know, you come join us. I know I'm an alcoholic, let me tell you about myself, what I did. I'd really like to learn a lot about you, but, like, we're not going to force you to stay, we're not going to, you know, lock the doors, we're not going to chain you to a chair, you know, we're not going to do any of those things. So it's a lot of very easygoingness a little bit, right? But at the end of it, it's like, but let's just be clear. Like, if you go out or you choose not to stay here, like, our hats are off to you. We hope you can drink like a gentleman or a gentlewoman or whatever you want to call it. And you can always come back. The key is to just not die while you're out there because you do have a fatal illness, you know? And those are the types of things that I've always been taught. You have to make sure you're very candid about when you're talking to someone about their alcoholism. I come to AA because I have a fatal illness, you know, and this is the only thing that's helped keep me alive. So the other thing here is the last paragraph on 95. It says, if he thinks he can, sorry, I'm jumping ahead quickly. On the bottom of page 95, it says, if he thinks he can do the job in some other way or prefer some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his own conscience. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that worked with us. But point out that we alcoholics have much in common and that you would like, in any case, to be friendly. Let it go at that. So most people that I talk to when they're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, had the same concerns I did, where they were like, I've heard the word God here a few times. I've saw the word God written in places. I've heard the word higher power. I've heard the crazy one, spiritual experience, right? I don't know what that thing is, you know, and spiritual awakenings and a lot of things that make me feel like I'm going to be floating 3 inches off the ground the rest of my life, walking hand in hand with an invisible God. And those things are kind of scary, you know? And so I was told, you know, make sure that they, you know, and I know this is an analogy that's used often, but I guess it's just the appropriate one to say, like, make sure that people know that the hoop you have to jump through is a lot wider than you think, right? That they can have their own conception of God, that there is some excitement in it, in the fact that, you know, you're actually able to develop this relationship with a higher power on somewhat of your terms, in terms of what you are going to conceptualize your own higher power to be. I found that to be extremely helpful because many people that I've talked to, they all want to hit the God thing right away when I'm talking to them, because they're like, well, I can't really stay in AA because I'm not religious, right? Or I can't go to AA because I don't pray. You know, I can't do this or I can't do that. And a lot of it is spiritual or God-based. There's a God blocker of some sense that they have. And so, you know, I was taught, like, you know, just get it out of the way. Like, yeah, you're going to hear about God, you know, and it's okay. You don't have to have that part figured out yet. We're not asking you to write it down in stone. There's no blood oath, you know, there's nothing like that. So, you know, we have to, you know, take it a little bit easy in that sense. Now, the last couple of things here that I'll mention that I found really helpful here. I know we have coming up on the time, but Page 97, the whole paragraph about never avoid these responsibilities. Be sure you are doing the right thing if you assume them. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. That whole paragraph talks about some of the things that might be asked of us when trying to help others or working with others. Right? You have to act a good Samaritan every day. It may mean loss of night's sleep. It may mean your phone ringing at 3 in the morning. Trips to police, courts, sanitariums, hospital, jails, and asylums. I've had to go to all those places. I've been to several of those places when I was drinking, but I had to go to all those places when trying to help somebody else. And I always summed it up like this. You know, somebody told me to write next to this paragraph in this book, write, be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced. You know, because that's what it is sometimes when you're helping other people. You're going to feel inconvenienced, but every single time you help somebody, you are going to have some sort of divine experience. So just go and do it. Just go and help them. You know, now I know that there's lines we have to draw. If somebody doesn't want to stop drinking, but they just feel like calling you every single night at 2 in the morning, you are going to have to say, hey, you know where to find us? And I'm not answering at 2 in the morning until you're ready to come. Like, this ain't the party line. I'm not here just for you to call up and talk to me because you got no one else to talk to at 2 a.m. and you think AA will talk to you all the time. Right? We got to say, hey, do you want to stop drinking? Yes or no? You know, and sometimes you have to cut those ties. You know, some of the other things that it talks about in here, I just want to talk about one that's important to me, is on the bottom of 100 and then into 101. It says, assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles when we go to their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. Okay, and then towards the bottom of that on 101, it says the second to last paragraph. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary whoopee parties. I still don't know what a whoopee party is. To a person who has had that experience with an alcoholic, you may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. I don't know what a whoopee party is. I'm not going to Google it because I'm a little scared of what might be come back on that search. But, you know, my point is that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard the term people, places, and things a lot. And I think that is very, very important for somebody in early recovery, right? When you're in early recovery, I don't think you should be the one manning the keg at a party, right? But I also had to be told that people, places, and things was not the way that I had to live the rest of my entire life. It was really, really important that I heard these pages on here because I had to know that I was going to be able to go places. I had to know that at some point, if my work wanted me to go somewhere, and it might be a networking event where there's alcohol being served, that I was going to be able to go there if I had a legitimate reason for going. Right? When Bill talks about his story and he's like, I'm thinking I might go into that bar because of the crowd inside and I'll just have a couple ginger ales. Like, that's not a legitimate reason for going in, right? And thank God he didn't go in there or we might not be in the place we're in today. Right? But at the same time, like, if I have a legitimate reason to be somewhere, I can be at that place, provided I am spiritually fit. So again, when I was in early sobriety, it wasn't a good idea for me to be going to those places, and so I didn't go those. But I had to understand that my life was not going to get smaller being in Alcoholics Anonymous, that it was going to get larger and far larger. And I've had the opportunity to go to some really cool places, all of which I've had a legitimate reason for being at, right? And I just had to do one simple thing when I was in those places, was not drink. You know, but this was also a big one when people would say, well, should I go here? Should I go there? That sort of thing. I'd say, well, let's just read what it says in the big book. Let's read these two pages and then let's talk about it. You know, and that's something that for me was incredibly powerful because, I just had to know that my life wasn't going to get tiny. I just had to know that I didn't have to be a hermit. Right? I just had to know that even if I couldn't go to all those places in that current moment when I was 10 days sober, that someday, if I did the things that were shown here, I was going to be able to have a life where it wasn't just consisting of going to a church basement and then driving as fast as I could home on roads with no bars on it and then locking myself in the basement at home, right? And those were the things that I have found I'm able to do quite a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'll close with some things here. I mentioned earlier that I've had a lot of really amazing things happen in the time that I've been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mentioned that most all of them are things that have happened to other people. The idea of helping others has been the foundation for me in my recovery. I don't do it perfectly. I can't tell you that I've dropped everything every single time that somebody wanted me to do something, because I have had other responsibilities. But my effort in trying to help other people, for me, I think, has been what has found me to be so happy in the life that I have today. And the idea that I never really know how I'm going to be helpful to somebody. So I don't know if anyone has had this experience, but I'll finish with this story. You meet somebody, you start picking them up, you start driving them to meetings, they call you here and there every once in a while. And, you know, sometimes you just assume, well, I'm going to end up being this person's sponsor, right? Because you're doing all this stuff with them. And then they don't ask you. And you're like, wait a second, I thought we had a thing going, you know? But, you know, that's the thing, is like, you can't just assume how you're going to be helpful. You're just there to do what God needs you to do at that time. Sometimes it's to be their sponsor. Sometimes it's to be like an experience that I had that taught me a lot about step 12, which is there was a guy who was coming around. He was having a tough time. He lived near me. He needed some help moving. We helped move him into a different place. He was constantly very, very sad and down and just, you know, couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, right? Just didn't see a way out, but he was coming, you know, and he had a solid step one, so he was going to keep coming. Drove him around a lot. One night we're driving in my car and we're driving and we're just talking and talking. And I don't know if we heard something on the radio or if it was something he said or something I said, but he laughed. And I looked in the back seat because I had never heard him laugh. And I looked in the back seat to see if there was somebody else in the car. And he looked in the back seat to see if there was somebody else in the car. Because he looked at me and I looked at him, and now I'm like, I got to look at the road, but I'm looking at you, because he's realizing this is the first time he's laughed in sobriety, and he was sober 60 days. A few weeks later, he moved one town over, but we have so many meetings, he started going to meetings around there. Didn't talk to him, didn't see him. And I was like, oh man, you know, I wonder what happened there. Like, you know, I hope he's getting involved. I hope he's got the, you know, all of a sudden I think I'm in control of his sobriety, right? Because I drove in the car with him a few times. And so I'm like, I hope he's doing this, and this. And I don't see him for 2.5 years. I go into a deli in the town over from me 2.5 years later, and he is behind the counter working, smiling and laughing. And he had to call me by name because I didn't recognize him with a smile on his face. And, you know, it was at that moment where I was like, you know, I got to stop deciding how I'm going to help people, and I just got to start living to help people, right? I've just got to start being available to be placed wherever I need to be placed and play the role that I am given by a higher power in this program. You know, I can't try and be in control all the time. I just have to show up. So my phone rings, you know, several weeks ago, and a guy says, hey, so-and-so gave me your phone number, and we'd like you to come up and share time with us at this big book workshop and all these things. My immediate thought is like, I have no idea what I'm getting into, but I guess I'm just going to say yes, you know? And it's been one of the bright spots of, one of the many bright spots within my recovery. So thank you guys for letting me be here, and thanks for letting me share.